Terrell out of Molloy, Iowa. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Harshini, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things. And no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
China says it acknowledges Iran's legitimate position of safeguarding its national interests on the nuclear issue. The Daesh terror group claims responsibility for Friday's attack on a Shia mosque in southern Afghanistan that left at least 41 people dead. British police declare the fatal stabbing of Conservative lawmaker David Amos a terrorist incident. This hour, Iran slams the European signatories of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal for what it called their inaction to salvage the accord. Iran's foreign minister made the criticism in a phone conversation with his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. Hossein Amir Abdullahian stressed Tehran's commitment to resuming the Vienna talks aimed at removing the U.S.'s anti-Iran sanctions. Wang Yi, for his part, said all the signatories to the deal, known as the JCPOA, must return to full compliance with their obligations. He said Beijing acknowledges Tehran's legitimate position of safeguarding its national interests on the nuclear issue. The two diplomats also stressed their country's willingness to promote bilateral ties. That includes a push for greater development of the Comprehensive Strategic Partnership deal the two sides signed earlier this year. Political commentator Robert Fantina says the three European signatories to the JCPOA have violated the agreement by their continued compliance with Washington's anti-Iran sanctions.
The Iranian foreign minister is correct in saying that the European signatories have not done enough. They also violated the agreement when the United States did, because then-President Donald Trump threatened to sanction any European country that continued dealing with Iran. Well, Trump is gone, so those countries, which never should have stopped trading with Iran in the first place, should start again now, and they're not doing so. their leaders are saying that Iran needs to get back to the table, Iran needs to be compliant. They are not compliant. The U.S. is not compliant. There is no reason for only Iran to comply with this agreement. The reason the Iranian government signed the agreement was for certain benefits, none of which are now being received. So there's no reason for Iran to continue. The JCPOA was essentially nullified when the U.S. withdrew from it. So anything Iran does not violate an agreement that no longer exists.
Multiple bomb explosions have ripped through a Shia mosque in the Afghan city of Kandahar, killing dozens of worshippers. More than 40 people are confirmed dead so far, and hospital sources say the toll could rise. Dozens of people are also injured. Daesh terrorists have claimed responsibility for the attack, in which three back-to-back explosions hit Imam Barqa Mosque during the Friday prayers. Eyewitnesses say one of the several assailants blew himself up inside the mosque. They say two more attackers detonated their explosive devices in crowded areas outside the main building. There were reports of gunfire as well. Political commentator Paul Larudi says Daesh terrorists from Syria are entering Afghanistan, wreaking havoc in the war-weary country.
It's easy to direct the anger and the blame to the to Daesh, to ISIS, because they are taking credit for it, and they are the ones that are taking the action, but who's behind them? I mean, who's causing all of this? The fighters of ISIS were being kept in more than 1,000 of them in Syria under, you could say, either the being detained or being taken care of by the U.S. Forces there. And the another name for the CIA is Daesh Air. That is, they transport them from one place to another, from northeast Syria to south Syria, Tanef, where they release them to do damage to the rest of Syria. And in this case, it seems that they have been moved in large numbers into Afghanistan to cause as much problem as possible.
Afghans have staged a rally in the Iranian capital to denounce a Daesh terror attack that killed scores of worshippers in Afghanistan's Kunduz province last week. Demonstrators called on the Taliban to take serious measures to uproot terrorism in Afghanistan. Yusuf Jalali reports from Tehran.
Angry and grieved, Afghan expatriates in Iran gathered to mourn the loss of dozens of their fellow citizens who were killed in a deadly bomb attack on a Shia mosque in the Afghan province of Kunduz last Friday. Claimed by Daesh terrorists, the assault was the deadliest since the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan in 2001.
I offer my condolences to my sad nation. We are all grieved for the loss of our fellow citizens. What wrong have they done? They were praying peacefully. The terrorists must be brought to justice.
The Taliban are accountable for what's happening. If they want to form a government, they must be able to ensure the security of our nation. Unfortunately, we heard that another terrorist attack was carried out today in another mosque. The Taliban must stop further terror attacks.
More than 150 people lost their lives in the attack at Ghuzar-e-Sayyadabad Mosque in the Khanabad area of Kunduz. A Daesh terrorist masquerading as a worshipper detonated his explosives during Friday prayers. The victims were all Hazara Shias, the third largest ethnic group in Afghanistan, something which is viewed as an attempt by Daesh to ethnically cleanse the country of Hazara Shia community.
The terrorists seek to eliminate the Shia population from Afghanistan. I wonder why the international community is silent about this massacre. Why is the West keeping mum?
Others see the bigger picture. They say the attack is masterminded by the U.S. as an attempt to push the war-ravaged country into yet another crisis after Washington's humiliating retreat from Afghanistan.
Certainly, the U.S. is behind the terror attacks in my country. It seeks to destabilize Afghanistan to imply that without American troops, Afghanistan will face troubles.
Friday's attack is the first since the Taliban announced an interim government in Kabul last month. Iranian officials have repeatedly insisted on the formation of an inclusive government as a way to rid the country of terrorism, bolster public security, and pave the way for a peaceful Afghanistan.
People view the deadly attack as a legacy from years of American presence on the Afghan soil. They also warn of its domino effect, saying all eyes are now on the Taliban to punish the perpetrators and prevent the recurrence of such incidents, to prove that they're capable of bringing peace to Afghanistan. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Attempting to compensate for the loss of lives inflicted on an Afghan family, the Pentagon has offered to pay an unspecified amount of money to the family that lost 10 members, including children, in a U.S. drone strike. In a statement, the Pentagon said it was also working with the State Department to help the surviving relatives relocate to the U.S. However, the victim's family had earlier demanded a face-to-face apology in addition to compensation. 10 civilians, including 7 children, were killed in a drone strike in Kabul on August 29th. The U.S. military initially defended the strike, saying a Daesh suicide bomber was the target. Later, the U.S. Defense Department called the attack a tragic mistake that happened just days before the complete U.S. military withdrawal from Afghanistan. Mike Harris is the editor at Veterans Today and joins us now from Phoenix. Mike, what do you make of this, Mike? Just a compensation and offer of relocation to the U.S., is that enough?
Well, no. First of all, no amount of money can replace a child or a family member. To offer money is somewhat insulting. And if it was me, I would be offended at anyone who offered to replaced my child with dollar compensation. Relocation to the U.S. Is also not an adequate compensation. One must realize that the U.S. has been very cavalier and careless with the treatment of civilian lives in Afghanistan as well as Iraq for many, many years. This is nothing new. They've used drone strikes indiscriminately. There was a particular wedding where 47 civilians were killed because they thought one adversary, a member of the Taliban, may have been there, and he was not. So the U.S. has a history of essentially war crimes against civilians in Afghanistan, and it is a shame. The offer of money is an insult, and if I was the family, you just cannot replace a child or a family member with cash. It doesn't work.
Right. So. And Mike, you raise, intelligence and Iraq. American intelligence is under the spotlight again. Question marks will be raised. It's not just Iraq, it's many other countries, including Yemen, for example, where Washington provided the intelligence for Saudi warplanes to strike pretty much residential areas.
Well, you have to look at the U.S. military holistically. The enlisted are among the finest fighting force in the world. The NCOs are world class. The company grade officers are among the best. The field grade officers are also excellent. We run into problems when we get into the flag grade and the command level of the generals, the admirals, etc. Those seem to be men who have weak character and do not make decisions very logically or dispassionately, caring about either their troops or about the civilians that they may harm. We have some real problems internal to our military at the highest levels. These issues need to be addressed. We see it everywhere we look, everywhere we turn. A lot of it is, I suspect, that a lot of times these men are succumb to greed and or other outside influences, whether it's personal compromise, blackmail, whatever, by outside foreign forces, primarily Israel, perhaps others. But we have a real problem in the U.S. with morality and following a moral code amongst our highest commanders. and they seem to have abandoned the principles that the United States was founded upon, and they're pursuing other interests right now. This is gravely troubling. Like I said, our enlisted, our NCOs, our field grade, our company grade officers, among the finest in the world. It is the problem is with the leadership class that must be confirmed by the Senate, and the Senate itself is a cesspool of corruption. So the U.S. has problems. We've become a gangster country, and this is a tragedy for the United States, as well as Afghanistan, Iraq, and any other country in the world that the U.S. Puts its crosshairs. So I don't know what to say, but the offer of money to replace my child, I would be offended. I would want to take the life of the person who made the offer, because you cannot replace my child. So anyway, I hope I've made that clear, and people of the United States feel great compassion and sorrow for the people of Afghanistan for the folly of our leadership in this country.
Absolutely. Mike, thank you very much indeed. Mike Harris, the editor at Veterans Today, joining us out of Phoenix. Moving on, British police have declared the fatal stabbing of Conservative Party's lawmaker David Amis a terrorist incident. The Metropolitan Police say the early investigation has revealed a potential motivation linked to extremism. A 25-year-old British man of Somali origin was arrested at the crime scene in Leon Sea town east of London. Police say they are not seeking anyone else over the murder. The veteran MP was talking with voters at a church when he was stabbed to death on Friday. Lawmakers are now pressing for tougher security. Home Secretary Priti Patel has ordered police across the country to review security arrangements for all 650 MPs. 69-year-old Amis was the second sitting lawmaker murdered in just over 5 years. Jo Cox from the Labour Party was killed in 2016 while meeting her constituents. Youth unemployment rises in the EU, while at the same time employers cannot find skilled workers. The European Commission says major reforms to education systems are essential. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Education is considered a fundamental right in the 27-nation European Union, but questions are being raised around the effectiveness of school curriculums. The number of young people who find themselves without a job in the bloc is growing.
We look for jobs. It's very hard to find, especially in the pandemic, and a lot of people lost their jobs. So it's even harder now to find a job.
What do you think?
I think it's not only about jobs. We didn't go to university for 2 years, and people graduated from home. It's an event of a lifetime, and they didn't get to do it.
Nearly all my friends don't have jobs, and the ones who have are paid an absolute misery, because it's not only the having or not having a job, it's having a decent pay.
EU Jobs Commissioner Nicola Schmidt attended a meeting of EU employment ministers on Friday. During an online press conference following the meeting, we pointed out that youth unemployment was already out of control in several EU nations prior to the pandemic, namely in Greece, Spain and Italy.
How confident can we be now that solutions can be found after the pandemic, when we couldn't really find solutions before the pandemic?
Many sectors are desperately looking for skilled persons, for skilled people, and they do not find them. And this shows us that there are major mismatches on our labour market.
So the Commissioner believes reskilling for the digital age is the answer, but the European Commission has been talking about that now for almost a decade. Economists are saying official EU youth unemployment data at present is misleading. COVID-19 financial supports have been keeping jobs alive, but these government programs are now being withdrawn. A potential tsunami of job losses is being forecast. The vast majority of those in precarious employment are young adults. Associated mental health issues and homelessness are big concerns. An EU social summit is scheduled for next Wednesday. Civil society organisations say the problems are well known. It's time, they say, to finally find solutions. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all. From the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee, and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me in full in the days gone by. Oh, the most merciful.
In the limelight.
Health experts have warned against what they called a twindemic of COVID-19 and flu this coming winter season, according to a news report. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Elisha Machado, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Health Experts Warn of Possible Twindemic as Flu Season Approaches. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As COVID-19 cases continue to drop and people scale back on protocols, doctors say there is concern that more people will catch the flu this year than last year. Health experts are warning of what could be a twindemic this year as flu season approaches during the COVID-19 pandemic. Doctors say the last flu season was mild because people were limiting social gatherings and wearing masks. The U.S. is gearing up in case of a bad flu season on top of the continuing COVID-19 crisis, with a plea for Americans to get vaccinated against both. Dr. Rachel Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said, "I get it. We are all tired of talking about vaccines, but it is doubly important this year to get your flu shot," added Walensky, who got her own vaccination earlier this week, just as she has every year since she was a medical student in 1995. She said, "We are preparing for the return of the flu in the U.S." However, as coronavirus cases continue to drop and people scale back on these protocols, there is concern that more and more people will catch the flu this year than last year. There is no doubt that this year the flu season will be worse than last year, but that's because last year was so good. There were very little cases. Dr. Olise Wu, chief epidemiologist and system director of infectious diseases for Hartford Healthcare, said. Wu anticipates flu cases will have a similar timeline as previous years, with sporadic cases through October, with more showing up in November and December before a peak in February. But he expects the flu could affect more people this year than last year. The two main reasons, flu shot hesitancy and people not wearing masks as much. Wu added, there are some masking mandates, but for the most part, there is not mandated masking, and so because of that, this is a respiratory transmitted disease, and by science alone, when you take away a barrier, you are going to have more cases of influenza. As healthcare providers keep an eye on both viruses, there are some steps you can take to stay safe this flu season. Vaccination is still the primary way to prevent that, and I'd encourage everyone, including kids, to go out and get that flu shot this year. That's one really important step for prevention. Dr. David Banich with the Infectious Diseases Department at UConn Health said, "The masks provide that higher level of protection, so in crowded indoor environments, that can be helpful as well. Doctors are also recommending masking up for gatherings, along with getting vaccinated and having outdoor get-togethers."
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. A moment before the break of dawn, life in the Niger begins with the rhythm of the calm, small, brilliant waves of the lakes of Mali. Calm and silent, yet glistening with life, this magical place lies right in the middle of the vast, burning desert of Africa. As the sun peaks over the horizon, life's current gains momentum. The inhabitants, mostly farmers, begin their day early, making their living by selling goods, and one can see more people starting off their working day as well. Residents of the beach are rather laid back. Men congregate to play games together and listen to the radio. Life is simple here, much like the type of goods the people sell. As simple, perhaps, as preparing a cup of tea.
Banned books.
Not far away, mothers are working too. As they work, they sing their songs of legend that tell traditional tales of their history. Folklore of kings and lesser rulers with their faces hidden behind wooden masks. They had won battles against beasts and great wizards, and they had discovered great treasures, all in the name of an expansive, mystical land called Mali. Not all of Mali's tales, however, are of legend. This country has survived the intrusion of a number of colonial empires, which occupied Western Africa. It is also a land that has experienced thriving times in the past. But here in the 21st century, Mali is devastated. Once a land of significant architectural development that denoted an accomplished civilization, these mementos are fading and might one day be all but forgotten. Villagers, seemingly unchanged by historical events of the past, live next to the remnants of centuries-old kings' palaces.
In Mali, Senegal, and other countries, including Ghana and Niger, governments were feudal and consecutive royal dynasties ruled over this region. This place that you see here is the government's court. It is a royal's property that belongs to Bambara dynasty.
Mm-hmm.
Dagon tribe is one of the most mystifying tribes in Mali. Some believe they are in regular contact with extraterrestrial beings. They are deeply knowledgeable about the stars and heavens. Deserted but resilient homes of the Dagons stand deep in the heart of the Bandiagara land. Among several such villages, one or two allow visitor access, while the rest are categorized as a forbidden zone for any non-native.
Did you know that these small houses belong to pygmies who built them more than 2,000 years ago?
Do you mean the tribes of short people?
Yes, the pygmies were forced to emigrate from here and move to Central Africa, to a country which is now involved in a horrible civil war. About 1,000 years ago, the Dagons migrated to this area. They were also natives of Bandiagara, but there were theological differences with the Muslim community there, and the Dagons didn't want to abandon their traditional customs, so they decided to emigrate and resettle within this territory to form their own society. This new land proved a very good place for them to live and grow. The environment meant that they were protected from wild animals, and hostile tribes could not effectively attack them either. These are the reasons, it is said, that the Dagons took over this territory and ousted the pygmy population, who were the original builders of these houses.
The meaning of the black means the mud, the soil, la terre, and then the white means the water, and the skies, and then the red means the sacrifice blood, animals, and that is the sun over there.
They said they should be there to be away to see enemies coming from a distance, because sitting there you can see back of the plain land, and then if there is enemy coming you can see, and they can't come from your up, they will fall
but
down.
But how could they get, you know, their food and the water from?
They get their food and water, they come to hunt, and then they go up there back. Enemies will not be fighting you all the time of the day.
It could be difficult for them, you know, just to coming down.
That is why today you see them living downstairs.
Yes.
The people of this village are origin of this place. But the present people of today are nothing belongs to them. But, it's from great grandfather
generation
to
after generation,
after generation. And they are all here to protect it.
It was a time of long, dark nights, but brilliant days full of optimism and accomplishment. Legendary civilizations that were no less than those of the great ancient civilizations. Tribes that built impenetrable resistance could not be dominated by their enemies, and they prevailed. Faces of heroes were carved proudly on totems as mementos and as symbols of strength and fortitude. One might imagine these civilizations as primitive, but in many ways, they were not. Timbuktu is a gem in the heart of the African desert. A legendary city first established as a major commercial center in West Africa 900 years ago. Today, it is remote and desolate. Islam became prominent in Mali in the 1300s under the leadership of Mansa Musa, who built 5 mud brick mosques, creating the beginning of an empire. The religion took its inhabitants out of paganism to the worship of one almighty God.
Prior to Islam, the mystical traditions of Sufism were imbued in Malian society, and while Islam penetrated the indigenous consciousness of the people, local customs and beliefs persisted also. The period produced economic prosperity and attracted many Muslim scholars and traders. Today, Muslims make up 90% of Mali's population. Until recently, its society lived in relative peace with one another, tolerant of minority religions, and integrated into societal norms. Sufism in Mali has been the origin of many defining moments that includes successful resistance against colonialism. These are numerous sects in Mali Sufism. One of the most important and most followed is Tijuana. But all of these sects are devoted followers of the Ahlul Bayt, people of the house of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which includes the Imams of Islam.
Go to work there to see the people, to talk with the people, to don't make it again.
To solve the problem
to
peacefully.
To solve problem for the peace, not for the guerra. Yeah, to talk with them, and then Mali will be nice country with them, to talk to them, not for the fighting. The Muslims pray every time to their good idea.
What about the French soldiers?
Huh?
There are plenty of them here.
French soldiers. Many is here.
The presence of the French in Africa, especially in Mali, is a story of centuries of attempts at imperial conquest and colonization.
From 1905 to 1932, here has been the seat of a French ruler. Now, what had happened during these 27 years in these houses?
And what decisions were made?
God knows.
In the majority of their captured colonies in Western Africa, the French have spread radicalism, which adopts the belief that one race is superior over another race of people, and it is this radicalism that ensures colonies fulfill their responsibilities towards their lords. French soldiers are committed to fight for France's imperial interests, and the people of Mali must share their earnings and wealth with their colonial lord. The statue of Louis Archinard, a revered general of France's conquest of Mali in the 1800s, looks in the direction of Niger Beach, in a corner of the historic city of Sego, as a daily reminder that Malians are under French control. Mali gained its independence in 1960. However, slavery has persisted to this day. The French are well known throughout their own history as world-class enforcers of slavery, oppression, and even genocide. And so, for the people of Mali, there is likely to be no freedom from slavery when this French intervention changes form. When the war ends in Mali and everything reverts back to normal, lords remain lords and slaves must continue their slavery. war will become history soon enough, and the period of French colonialism will also one day end to make way for so-called democratic government. But the benefits reaped by the conquerors from natural resources will continue covertly, leaving only the crumbs for the native population. Mali possesses a wealth of vital natural resources such as petroleum, gas, and uranium, used for atomic weaponry and the functioning of nuclear reactors. It provides abundant wealth to large French corporations, such as ARVA. ARVA, founded in 1958 in Paris, had always been at the top of French nuclear negotiations. The company is involved wherever African uranium is mined, and Mali is no exception. Tragically, while French politicians and business moguls enjoy their spoils and media spin, and a new government favorable to French interests is formed for Mali to complete its recolonization, the people of Mali will pay the ultimate price, that of widespread poverty forced upon them in order to guarantee control over their resources. It's difficult to imagine the horror these people must have witnessed in the throes of civil war, neighbor warring against neighbor, brother against brother. It all must have made little sense to those in the firing line. The people's expectations would have been vastly different from the terrible reality that ensued. Who will bind the nation's wounds once this is all over? Disintegrated economy, starving infants, poverty and unemployment directs most everybody towards violence as a last resort, and especially when there are serious external motives. Tuaregs are nomadic tribes in the north of Mali. One can find Tuaregs eking out a living from Libya and Algeria to the north of Mali. They are a people who feel always deprived and ready to protest. After Mali's independence, Tuareg tribes became a target of the French colonists, who sought to motivate them against the central government and thereby to weaken the new government. A weak central government can be easily corrupted and taken over by a colonial power. This time, Arab allies of Western powers and manipulation of the petrodollars would serve to help hoist the blood-covered flag of Takfiri terrorists over captured territory. The modus operandi of these Takfiris is to first destroy buildings that belong to the Sufis that brought Islam to Africa and fought against colonialists. Takfiris are exceedingly brutal in their methods of spreading fear through decapitation, torture, and rape and murder, that it would frighten the Malians in a way that they will never forget. With the intrusion of foreign-sponsored terrorists and mercenaries, the future for Mali was laid out. Northern cities would fall one by one, and the Black Flag government would replace Malian government and would rule over Mali. The Malian army is not able to confront such a level of threat that worked its way closer to the capital moment by moment. The increasing fear of a Takfiri takeover would strongly encourage Malian authorities and its people to welcome past occupiers. The French army simply waited in the wings for their chance to act and return to recolonize Mali, only this time as the role of perceived savior. It would then proceed to expel the Takfiris and take over Mali's northern cities itself, one by one. Timbuktu, formerly the cultural capital of Western Africa, was attacked by the terrorist group Ansar al-Din, linked to Al-Qaeda, who saw their opportunity in the confusion following the military coup which ousted the former Malian government in 2012. Timbuktu became the training academy for Al-Qaeda terrorists. Today, Timbuktu is charged as the keeper of sacred scripts and treasures, which are under protection in selected libraries of the city. Once a cultural heritage burns in the fire of ignorance and prejudice, or is stolen and sold to private collectors, museums, or to London or Paris antique markets, the people no longer have that pillar of strength to lean on. It's as if a part of them has been taken and is now missing from their soul. And after that, their power to resist diminishes. Timbuktu's burnt books is the symbol of the rich and brave culture of the people who resisted against enemy attacks and threats of destruction of its antiquities for hundreds of years. Malians have been bent, but haven't broken. They have withstood countless invasions and persecutions, and all the while have kept their customs, culture, and religion. For the past 3 years alone, they have dealt with a government takeover, civil war, foreign terrorism, as well as local terrorism and rebellion, displacement of masses of people, government collapse, and destruction of the country's most endearing artifacts. Mali could be described as a failed state. The people have endured this traumatic experience, and there remains cautious optimism for the future. This is a testament to their strength of character. The country has lost some of its sovereignty. However, it is hard for one to be optimistic about the independent future of Mali. Already having lost some of its sovereignty to former colonial master France, Mali struggles both against foreign-sponsored terrorism and the relentless interference in its internal affairs by the West.
In the limelight.
Democratic lawmakers are facing the complex task of deciding what and how to cut from a massive $3.5 trillion spending plan, with a month's end deadline looming. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Lisa Hagen, a politics reporter for U.S. News & World Report. The piece is titled, What Faces Cuts in Democrats' Social Spending Plan. Democratic lawmakers are facing the complex task of deciding what and how to cut from a massive $3.5 trillion spending plan, with a month's end deadline looming. Democrats are promising transformational change as they push for programs like universal pre-kindergarten, expanded Medicare benefits, and paid family leave. But with political resistance within their own party to the estimated $3.5 trillion cost of the social safety net package, some parts will inevitably face cuts. Now members face the intricate exercise of deciding what exactly gets scaled back. Complicating matters, House and Senate leaders, as well as the White House, are tasked with finding a compromise on the massive second half of President Joe Biden's economic agenda that moderates and progressives can both support before a new deadline of passing the first part a bipartisan infrastructure bill by 31st of October. The two bills are linked since progressives won't support the infrastructure vote until the social spending plan is at least finalized. Negotiations over revised top-line spending are ongoing, and moderate members were clear from the start they wouldn't accept such an expensive package. That means Democrats might need to pare back their legislation by at least $1 trillion, if not more. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, one of two Democratic holdouts in the upper chamber, has set his marker around $1.5 trillion. The other, Senator Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, hasn't publicly specified what she'd feel comfortable with to get her support. With Democrats pursuing the budget reconciliation process to pass the bill without needing any GOP votes, the party will need all 50 Democratic senators aligned in order to advance it. And while it's unclear what exactly will get cut in the social spending plan, there's also debate over how to downsize the legislation. Democrats are trying to juggle warring factions of their own party, but need to carefully decide what priorities might take a hit, since doing so will have real-world implications for millions of Americans, and potentially political ones, since party leaders vowed to strengthen healthcare, education, and climate if they won full control of the government. We have some important decisions to make in the next few days so that we can proceed, said House Speaker Nancy Pelosi of California. She added, I'm very disappointed that we're not going with the original $3.5 trillion. If there are fewer dollars to spend, there are choices to be made, but we will not diminish the transformative nature of what it is. The debate has centered on whether to completely take out key components of the package or reduce the number of years of each. This week, Nancy Pelosi indicated both scenarios are possible. In a Monday, 11th of October letter, Nancy Pelosi wrote that a strong contingent in her caucus wants to do fewer things well, a position long held by centrist Democrats, including the New Democrat Coalition. But on Tuesday, 12th of October, she alluded to the progressive view of reducing the number of years for programs first. Some have said they want to do everything, so we'll have that discussion, Pelosi told reporters on Tuesday. So mostly we'll be cutting back on years and something like that. There's also disagreement over who should qualify for benefits in the reconciliation bill. Joe Manchin believes there should be means testing to ensure help is going to working class and lower income families and individuals, which can also reduce costs of the package. But on a recent press call, Senate Budget Committee Chairman Bernie Sanders of Vermont argued that the middle class tends to get left out of receiving government assistance and maintains that the program should be universal. Regardless of how Democrats ultimately rein in spending, dozens of priorities are at stake. As of now, the wide-ranging 10-year plan would fund programs like tuition-free community college, affordable housing, 12-week paid family and medical leave, universal pre-K, child care assistance and expanded Medicare benefits that include hearing, dental and vision. Democrats are also seeking an extension of the child care tax credit created under their COVID-19 relief bill, which gives families $3,600 per child under the age of 6 and $3,000 per child for children aged between 6 and 18. Democrats plan to fund their legislation by raising taxes on large corporations and wealthier Americans, but have pledged not to for those earning less than $400,000 a year. The many pieces of the social spending bill address a range of communities across the country, including seniors, children and young adults, people of colour, families and caretakers. Scaling back on some priorities could take a toll on certain groups and form a political perspective, are bound to frustrate activists and base workers who have a vested interest in these areas. While the exact cuts are uncertain, one battleground is over healthcare. Moderates are more focused on extending Affordable Care Act subsidies that were also in federal pandemic relief legislation and closing the coverage gap in states that won't expand Medicaid. Progressives, on the other hand, say they're committed to broadening Medicare, which they see as a way to get them closer to their goal of a Medicare for All healthcare system. Bernie Sanders said expanded Medicare benefits are not negotiable. Plus,